Welcome to Nightlife, a bite-size episode.
At the Movies with CJ Johnson.
CJ, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip. Thank you very much. Very happy to be here.
Well, it's good to share some movie talk with you again as well. So, two movies. What have you seen?
I have seen Perfetti Sconosciuti, also known as Perfect Strangers, which is being very, very, very aggressively marketed in Australia, I have noticed. It is full-page ads being taken out for it in all the major markets around the country by Palace Cinemas because it did extremely well at, you know, what everyone laughingly calls Italy's Oscars. I really hate that sort of cultural imperialism that whatever Italy's Academy of Motion Pictures is called, they just say Italy's Oscars, but whatever Italy's Oscars is.
There was a European film industry well before there was an American film industry.
Exactly. Anyway, this film won a lot of big awards at the most recent version of those, including Best Film. It is the new film from a guy named Paolo Genovesi. Mm-hmm. And as I say, it's called Perfect Strangers in its English iteration. And it follows in the line of this type of Euro romp that particularly the French and Italian do a lot, which is to take a single contemporary location, and very often that involves a table and food, and some very popular actors, usually from film and television, locally popular actors, and give them a lot of dialogue and have your film. And if this is, okay, you know, if it's successful, then it's a very good business model because it's one set and, it, you know, you can shoot it pretty quickly. And of course, if it's not successful, the risk it runs is that it's stagey and just talkative and boring and looks cheap. So this one is one of those films. It's very contemporary. It's set right now. Everyone's wearing, they look like they're wearing what they probably wore to the set that day. You know, and usually these films, whether they're French or Italian, depict a particular, very specific subset of sort of upper middle class, forward thinking, progressive modern bourgeoisie. And that's exactly who we've got here. So we've got seven old friends who range from, you know, surgeons to kind of the perpetually unemployed, but the kind of perpetually unemployed Europeans who still dress very well and you sure have a nice car and a nice apartment because they're between jobs, but those jobs are relatively good. And the central conceit of the film, and it's a high concept, it really is that one of the characters decides that for the evening, as a kind of truth game, that they all put their mobile phones into the center of the table. You know, something spurs this, of course, and part of the script's job is to make this moment, this instigating incident happen semi-organically at least, is that they all put their mobile phones into the center of the table and that for the duration of the evening, any text or email that they receive is read out loud, that if they reply to it, they must announce what they are replying, and any phone call they take must be taken on speakerphone to the hearing benefit of the rest of the table.
Okay.
And her point, this character's point is, you know, well, if no one's got anything to hide, no one should care about this. So, of course, everyone's like, well, I got nothing to hide. And so everyone puts their phones into the center of the table. And it really isn't giving away a spoiler to suggest that, of course, secrets are revealed by this device and that everyone realizes that they didn't really know each other nearly as well as they thought they did, hence the title Perfect Strangers, Perfetti Sconosciuti. So you know where it's going and it's all about how does it get there. And as I say, if the script had been a little plonkier, this wouldn't have worked at all. No. And if the actors hadn't been excellent, this wouldn't have worked at all. But it's seven terrific actors and a slightly more than halfway decent script and well-directed, directed in a way that you're never fully saying to yourself, oh my goodness, this is all shot in one room around a single table with occasional, you know, excursions into the kitchen. But really, the actors sell it very well by playing the situation straight because it is a ludicrous situation, obviously. But, of course, all high-concept movies are.
Yeah. Gee, I would have thought the task is in the writing of something like this, because it's the writing that's going to propel it, isn't it?
The task is in the writing. Mm. And, of course, going into something like this, you start predicting it well before you go in. You start predicting it from the poster or from hearing the tagline, from hearing the concept. You're like, oh. And because it's Italian, then, of course, we all fall back a little bit on, oh, well, everyone's going to be having affairs of some variety. And to the film's credit, to the script's credit, it's cleverer than that. Mm-hmm. Not immensely, but it is cleverer than that. It isn't just a bunch of people's affairs being revealed on their phones. And so it does actually thwart your expectations by about 10%. But that is just the 10% that is required to keep you interested. So I saw this at the Hayden Cremorne Orpheum Picture House in Sydney. And for people who know that cinema, it is a beautiful cinema, absolutely gorgeous cinema, very, very well maintained from its original auspices. But it has a sort of upmarket and very mature audience. It generally tends to have, situated in Sydney's North Shore, Lower North Shore. And I saw it with quite a full house of such an audience, and they loved it. I have rarely been in recent years in such a vocally responsive cinema. Okay. Every twist and turn of the shenanigans of what appears on their mobile phones and how they deal with it was greeted by this audience with oohs and ahs and giggling and gasps. So it really was working its magic, and you can't argue with how a film plays to an audience. There's no doubt about that.
All right, Perfect Strangers, worth seeing by the sound of it. CJ Johnson's with me. We're talking about the movies. He's seen a couple of big ones this week, including Manchester by the Sea. Now, this is the vehicle for Casey Affleck, and many think it's going to take him to the Best Actor Oscar. I've had a look at this myself. What did you think of it, CJ?
I loved it.
I don't think I did. But
no,
anyway.
No.
Sorry, I know I didn't.
I know you didn't too, and that's quite interesting. And I look forward to discussing what about the same movie I liked so much that you didn't. It was originally, I think, intended as a vehicle for Matt Damon. At least, I believe he optioned or bought the rights to the screenplay.
Okay.
And then, for whatever reason, he couldn't do it. And so his best mate, Ben Affleck's brother, Casey Affleck, himself a very good actor, in fact, easily a better actor than Ben Affleck, ended up playing it. It's written and directed by a guy named Kenneth Lonergan, who is a very established playwright in the United States and screenwriter. And he's only got three films as writer-director to his credit, and he's on in years. He's no spring chicken. He'd probably be, I don't know, 60 or something. And so he takes his time to make his films, and his second film, Margaret, was famously delayed in post-production hell for about 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it got released, and it featured a teenage protagonist who the actress was very, very much an adult by the time the film came out, and she was on the circuit to promote it. So he takes his time and he stands up for what he believes in. And part of the reason Margaret was locked in this intense legal battle was because the studio wanted to release it one way and he didn't want to release it without it being his final cut. And so all sorts of shenanigans ensued. So he's got integrity, and this film, I believe, has integrity in spades. What you may have heard about it is that it's tremendously sad. What I'm here to say about it is that it's tremendously funny. I think Kenneth Lonergan...
Funny?
Yes, absolutely. I laughed...
Yeah, funny idea.
I
funny.
Laughed a lot. Because what
it's
he is...
miserable.
No. It's full of really, really witty banter, really sharp dialogue that goes back and forth, mainly between Casey Affleck's character and a young man called Patrick, played by Lucas Hedges. Basically, Casey Affleck is a janitor who looks after a bunch of buildings in Quincy, Massachusetts, a town I know on a personal level. And he is bearing the burden of the kind of grief that is absolutely full of guilt. He's got guilty grief, and I won't say why, but...
No, we mustn't say why.
No, but he's got guilty grief, and it's weighing him down. And then his brother, who is also his best friend, played by Kyle Chandler very well, dies. And up in the town north of Quincy in Massachusetts called Manchester by the Sea, a very picturesque town, and especially in this film. And he goes up to Manchester and has to essentially deal with the fact that his brother has made him the guardian of his teenage son, played by Lucas Hedges. And he's not ready to be a father, certainly not an instant father of a 15 or 16-year-old boy. And it's how these two deal with each other and basically deal with burying the father slash brother figure while dealing with each other's grief, and in his case, his grief, which is compounded by his already pre-existing grief. And most of it is essentially, if you were to give it some sort of genre label, a buddy movie. It's scenes in cars and in houses of these two and walking along these snowy, beautifully shot streets of Manchester by the sea, dealing with each other. And they deal with each other with wisecracks and sharp witticisms and low blows and a lot of really rough and tumble, realistic humor, the kind of humor that actually plays out between people.
Character?
I did.
He's a miserable, violence-prone loser.
Yes, but he has.
He doesn't go anywhere.
He has very difficult things. See, I think he does go somewhere, but I think this film, unlike a lot of films that show you a damaged character and then a second act that gives them a reason to live, and by the third act they're happy and gives them sort of their redemption from miserableism to happiness, this film, I believe, is much more realistic and gives you a redemption arc that is much subtler. It is sort of from miserable to seeing potentially a glimmer of light at the end of the film. Yeah, I really do. I really do. And I think that's the film's point. I think the film's point is that life moves slower than movies, partly. And that this film, you know, it is over 2 hours. I know you had a problem with the length. It's 2 hours and 16 minutes, I believe.
Yeah, you found it too long. At least 45 minutes too long. I thought. But that's only because I really did profoundly think that the character doesn't go anywhere, that by the end of the movie he's in the same. This isn't telling you anything, really. Ruining anything. I just don't think the character went anywhere. And it's of the acting school. It's of the school of acting where actors say, nope, nope, dunno.
Well, it's pure nothing, naturalism. It's,
nope.
Yeah, it's pure naturalism, also known as realism. But the dialogue is just a little bit heightened. Like, they speak, as I say, I think it's realistic dialogue, but no one's really that witty for extended, you know, long scenes like that. You know, I think it's, and I think that dialogue is very well handled. It's funny because the image I had of this film going in was that it was kind of more what you're describing, which is 2.5 hours of a guy moping around. And it's not. There's an enormous amount of very rapid dialogue in this film. He's always speaking. He's always trading bards.
It still is 2.5 hours of a guy moping around. I'm now, here to tell you, Michelle Williams is very good.
She is very good. She is kind of, I was going to say flashback, seen mainly in flashback, but that's actually belying the film's complicated structure, because the entire film is temporally fractured, like a Quentin Tarantino film often is. It is not told linearly, and I really admired how intricately it was told, because it's not just in one, two, or three different time frames. It's actually in a kaleidoscope of time frames, and any scene might follow. Let's say there are 60 scenes, for example. They're almost in a random order, except they're not. They're the opposite. They're in a highly specific order, but they are never in linear order.
No, you're quite right, and it is clever that way, because you never actually get frustrated. But you know how that technique can sometimes be very frustrating, because you never know where you are. You sort of always do know where you are.
But it's so clever. Like, there's one sequence that the main character is in a hospital, and it's only at the end of the sequence that you realize that you've actually seen two different time frames going on, and he's actually not wearing the same outfit, but it's subtle. And so it's only at the end that you realize, oh, wow, the last two scenes were actually disconnected by about 2 years, but they actually played next to each other in the same hospital, you know? So you've got to go in with your thinking cap on a little bit. Did you find it, I guess some people, potentially those who haven't seen it, are afraid it's like grief porn or anything. Did you think it wallowed too much in misery, or you just found the main character annoying?
I just found the main character annoying. But look, other people may respond differently. Look, on reflection, you're right. I mean, there is amusing dialogue in it, particularly the young man who is having all the usual attendant teenage issues. And watching an older man who knows and recognises this deal with them is funny, yeah.
And he's not really that much older either. I mean, no. Casey Affleck's younger than me, I would suggest, and I'm super young. But it's interesting too, because the film isn't just about him. The film really occasionally leaves Casey Affleck's character and follows Patrick, the Lucas Hedges, the young man's character, into different homes and with his girlfriends and stuff. So it's a bigger film than the marketing would make it out to be.
Granted, I'm just surprised. I suppose I'm just surprised by it. But look, this is Hollywood hype, isn't it? I'm just surprised by the hype about Casey Affleck, because although it's a good performance, I'd be surprised if this was the outstanding performance of the year, that's all.
Well, he just didn't win the Screen Actors Guild Award for Best Actor. That just went to Denzel Washington for a movie which we haven't reviewed on this program yet called Fences. So that actually slows his momentum dramatically for the Oscars. I think it's a very good performance. It is high realism, so it is sort of mumblecore.
Go in a good frame of mind. All right. Good to talk, CJ, as always.
Thank you very much, Philip.